today then is the question of white involvement within South Africa in the struggle against apartheid. And what I've put up here is just the five sections of what I'm going to be talking about, just so that you've got a sense of where I'm going, and so that I've got a sense of where I'm going to. The thing that I've found in the year that I've been here is that for a lot of people, one of the more interesting things is which planet did I sort of drop off? Not so much did I come from England or Australia or why was I in Africa, but how does a white South African who's supposed to be for apartheid ended up being against apartheid? I mean, it becomes a sort of an interesting thing. So the first question I ask is white involvement with the question mark. What is white involvement? How can there be white involvement in the struggle against apartheid? Because the way it's been portrayed, especially in the American media, and the way that the South African government likes it to portray it, is that it's a white versus black conflict. All whites are fighting all blacks. And that's, from the South African government point of view, that's a useful way of expressing it because it takes morals out of the debate. I mean, if it's simply everybody who's black who's fighting everybody who's white, well then there is no moral issue, because there's nothing more intrinsically moral about being black or being white. For me, the way I've often thought about it, it's like saying that the Second World War was simply all Germans fighting all British, simply because the British hated the way the Germans spoke and looked, and the Germans hated the way the British spoke and looked. You know, that's so often how South Africa is understood, that it's just one culture fighting another because they hate each other. Whereas the Second World War, one might want to argue that there were underlying reasons. There was the invasion of Poland, so there was the question of involving yourself in other countries' rights. There was the question of democracy. There was the question of totalitarianism. There was the question of imperialism on both sides. But you see what I'm getting at? I mean, behind a conflict, there's always questions that raise morals. And the South African debate is often blurred because people want to get it away from morals, especially the government. So hopefully in the discussions that we've talked about, and perhaps in the individual times you've had to talk to Marion and I, you've seen perhaps that the South African thing is not just all whites against all blacks, but is understood, or can be understood, as a struggle for justice and democracy and freedom. Perhaps closer to your own history, the War of Independence, and I've been reading some stuff now with the 200th anniversary of the Constitution that calls into question some of the things about the War of Independence. But anyway, the idea that it wasn't simply all the Americans fought all the British simply because the Americans hated the British. I mean, it was perceived as a struggle for independence, against colonialism, for republicanism, against monarchy. Do you know what I'm getting at in that thing? And I think that's, once you start to see the South African struggle like that, then we can start talking about white involvement, because then the option comes into being that a German could be involved against Hitler, or a British person could be a conscientious objector, or Americans might have fought for the British, or British people or French people even might have fought for the Americans. So it makes the thing much more, complex, but it also enables those abnormalities to happen. So that's where I want to start, is that hopefully, as we've talked about it, and especially in our discussion of the African National Congress and the United Democratic Front on, when was that? Was that Monday night? As being non-racial organizations that are committed to a non-racial future, in other words, white and black, but also a non-racial process to get there. Okay, so the white community of basically, we can divide the white community into four. For some of you, again, this you would have got a bit of this. How can I put it? Reactionary, conservative, liberal, and then sorted bunch of lunatic fringe type people, and left or progressive.
this isn't any normal society, this is the labels that they would get. It gets a bit complicated because the names of the parties do not match the categories I've given them. The reactionaries are made up by the Conservative Party, and they're about 30% of South Africa, South African whites. The Conservatives are made up by the Nationalist Party, and we can perhaps talk about 55, I think, is the percentage we... The Liberals are made up by the Progressive Party. You can see it's getting complicated at this point. We're going to give them about 10. These figures are getting slightly wrong because I want to try and get them to make 100. And then the left or progressive in the white community are the people who belong to the United Democratic Front, the UDF. And they're about 2% of the white community. And there'll be a few percentage people who just enjoy surfing, watching TV. Maybe I've given a little bit. I see in my paper there we've put 25 and 15, but you know this is a kind of subjective feel for what is the situation. Now these three groupings participate in the white parliamentary politics: Conservative Party, Nationalist Party, Progressive Federal Party. This group of whites says that in fact Parliament, which is for whites only, is part of the problem, not part of the solution. And that the real opposition is not the whites in opposition to the government, but the black majority. And that the role of white people who are critical of apartheid should be to be not trying to lead the struggle, not trying to be the great opponents, but in fact trying to aid the black resistance to apartheid. And so what I want to talk about today is this, which is the group where I feel at home in, where Marion feels at home in, and where our friends are generally congregated. This is very much the position of... somebody asked us yesterday, we were doing this little session for the staff, we couldn't get to the other one, they said, who belongs to this party? And Marion and I said, in perfect unison, my parents. The two of us said that. And this is really the case, that so many of these people, their parents belong to this party. But the experiences that we've had that were denied to our parents have made us move to the left, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. Although people like my parents in the past 2 or 3 years have also shifted out of that party and into the left grouping. Okay, what are some of the reasons that people join this group? So we're into this third section here. And in thinking about it, we've come up with five reasons. Now again, this is very abstract, and as I mentioned earlier, a book like Nadine Gordimer's Burger's Daughter will capture more of what the personal drama is all about in this, and these are going to be very abstract. I'm just thinking, by the way, in Afrikaans, a burger is a citizen, and I wouldn't know this, but I think she's playing on the word burger as a citizen's daughter. In other words, it's not... Although Burger is the surname, which is a common surname in South Africa, it actually is, she could be anybody's daughter, citizen's daughter. And I think there's a play there, but I think it captures that white, the dilemma, the reasons. The first one would be political values. We're brought up as white kids within the white, what's called Christian national education. And we're shielded so much from the reality of the world. That's probably true of most education systems around the world, but we're not only shielded, we're shaped. And the history we learn, for example, is European history and then white South African history. We're not allowed to discuss politics. Teachers are not allowed to discuss politics in the classroom. The syllabus that we write and we finish with when we matriculate out of high school is a government syllabus, and it's marked externally by government markers. I mean, people who paid teachers, but who salaried by the government. So even if you're in a progressive school like I was in, and the teacher who teaches you might be very sympathetic to an open political position, he can only teach you, or she can only teach you, the history that you're going to have to matriculate out with.
Do you see what I'm getting? I mean, even the progressively minded teachers are stuck with that. At school, in the final 2 years of high school, all white boys have to do what's called cadets. And on a Wednesday afternoon from 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock, we put on our little brown shorts and our brown shirts and we march up and down with guns. And it's supposed to keep us physically fit for the communist onslaught. So, anyway. But we're shielded. And what happens is, when one comes to university or reads about the American War of Independence, or one reads about the civil rights struggle here, or about the French Revolution, you start to hear things and to think of things, and your values, perhaps, you start wondering, what about justice? What about democracy? And perhaps if you're lucky enough, by the time you get to university, you'll be able to take courses or be able to join organizations that are their student organizations to help you understand that we don't live in a democracy, that we don't have a very just legal system, that there's a lot of oppression going on. So basically, pretty normal political values: justice, the rule of law, a bill of rights, freedom, that people have the right to congregate, to meet, to form trade unions, liberty, to be able to travel in the country of your birth. Those, you know, those pretty normal kinds of things in South Africa, if you start thinking about it, you shift pretty radically to the left. The second group of values would be religious values. And for me, this has perhaps been the most important one. The church is the one place where black and white people can actually meet and have interaction. And especially where black and white kids can have some kind of interaction. Not as much as they should be, but in my own case, for example, I have a pretty weird pilgrimage, because I came to faith in a Mennonite community in Kansas, which is a long way away from South Africa. My father was on sabbatical and we were in a Mennonite community there, and that was really my awakening. So I've always had the Mennonites have a particularly social concern message about their faith that I took with me. But the church that I belonged to was part of, its youth group belonged to a grouping of youth groups that included some black and colored youth groups. And one met and one discussed, what does the justice say that the prophets talk about, or the freedom that Paul talks about, or the sacrifice that Christ made? What does that mean for me in terms of loving my neighbor, in terms of doing justice, walking humbly? Those kinds of religious values that come through. In South Africa, it's a weird kind of dichotomy between faith and politics that I think actually exists probably throughout the world, where one is not allowed to think through what loving your neighbor really means in the situation. And so for a lot of people, that's become really important. And then especially the peace witness of the Bible, the question of peace and of long-suffering and forgiveness. When we're called on to participate in a violent system, that's become a real struggle for a lot of people. So political values, religious values. A third category that we thought of is black friends. Apartheid's been pretty good in terms of keeping whites from having black friends. Precisely because once you become involved in the life of another, who they are and the struggles they go through actually affects you in a pretty profound way. I often think, as I go to the bank these days, with the sanctions issue, all these banks and multinational corporations were put under so much pressure from sanctions that they suddenly had to show the world how enlightened they were, so they started quickly employing black bank tellers and black executives and all. But I often have been in the bank and there will be white and black bank tellers working next to each other. And now this is outside of the church and it's outside of university student politics and all that, where black and white friends are a really important thing. And the scenario goes through my head of the black teller coming in and saying, my father was beaten up by police yesterday. Now, if the person said that to that white person in any other context, that person might think, well, he's a communist, or he's, you know, he just doesn't like his lot, or whatever. But once they've become friends, once they've worked together in the bank for 6 months or whatever, it becomes more difficult for the white person to evade that person's life, that person's friendship. And that's been happening, I think, more and more for so many people. That the reality of the life that black people are going through has affected them in a way that apartheid wasn't allowing it to happen. In my own instance, the student group that I belonged to, which was called SUCA, Student Union for Christian Action, was a non-racial student group. And to meet and to be on an executive with and to have fellowship with black Christians who were suffering in terms of their education, in terms of their parents and whatever, has been probably the biggest growth point for me. It hasn't been theoretical at all. It's been knowing that Zwar Nebetalu, who's a Lutheran pastor in Venda, is under that kind of pressure, or that Gwen Ramakobo, who's a student at Madunsa, the Medical University of South Africa, black campus, is on boycott because the students feel that the white lecturers are treating them like dirt. And that involves you suddenly in so much more than just if you just had white friends. And I think you can get away with talking more rubbish and lying more if you don't have black friends to challenge you on that. A fourth reason is being placed in positions of overt violence. I think you can live with a situation for a long time until you're called on to do it. Now, obviously there are a lot of people who can do it, but whites who drafted into the military service, as kids they could live with the situation, they didn't have to think about it, but now suddenly they're being trained for 2 years to carry a gun and to kill, and to go into the townships and to kill black people who are South Africans. Now, do you know what I mean when I say you can live without having to face the consequences until you're forced to, and then suddenly you have to think through what it means? And that's become a really big thing in South Africa, that white youth, especially white males, who perhaps would have grown up without having to think about politics, because they've been put in a position of violence, are suddenly, perhaps they were at Sunday school and they were told love your neighbor, or perhaps they grew up with the gardener's son, or the maid that they had a child who, I mean, there could be hundreds of reasons, but suddenly being squished into that position of violence makes the moral ambiguity fall away, and suddenly you are called on to defend apartheid. And then the fifth reason is that these groups, like these kinds of political groups around the world, tend to be more accommodating of the fringe groups. So gay and lesbian organizations find these people more open to understanding what their struggle is and to supporting them. The ecological movement, in other words, the people against nuclear power, for example, find that this is a group of people who understands what their struggle is, and so they're more able to bring them in. And then all the cultural types. I don't know how I can, you know, the students, what they call it at Rhodes University in Grahamstown, they call them the bungies. They're the kinds of students who like to perhaps do drugs, or basically cultural misfits, but are there because they feel that the society is really bad and has treated them bad, and hey, you know, we've got to do a good thing for the society. And they cause a lot of tensions, obviously, and they can often make things more difficult. But what I'm trying to paint is that I think a fifth reason is that if you are in a fringe community, or if you're involved in a fringe issue, or even a major issue like feminism or the women's movement in South Africa, you'll find far more this group far more accommodating of you and accepting. I think that would probably ring true of a number of other societies. Okay, so let me stop there. Those are the five reasons we managed to drag out of the two of us in terms of our own experience and our friends. The areas where this involvement takes place then. The first area is in overt political activity. And here the United Democratic Front is the place where most people get involved. Now, The United Democratic Front is not an organization itself, it's a front of organizations, about 600 of them. And that includes women's groups and men's groups and sports groups and church groups and youth groups and cultural groups and women's groups and hundreds of small little groups that were all involved in their activity were united by the United Democratic Front. And most whites who, for those reasons I've suggested, or maybe even some more, their own personal reasons, who want to be involved specifically in political activity would be involved in the United Democratic Front or one of their affiliate organizations. And that's, even if you don't choose to be involved politically in that, that's sort of your political home. A second area would be in the area of what we call conscription and what the Americans call the draft. As I mentioned earlier, all white boys, men, are drafted or conscripted, as we say, into the military to serve a two-year period of military training, and then I suppose you get used for what you've been trained to do in that two-year period. Now, up until 1980, basically the army had been used in Namibia to basically control and colonize Namibia. And that was a moral dilemma for some people. And the first conscientious objectors in South Africa, two guys called Peter Moll and Richard Steele, they were both Baptists. The one, a cynical just war just war theologian and economist. The other, who happened to be his cousin, was a Gandhian pacifist vegetarian. So you had these two, both wonderful people, just amazing. I lived with Peter Moll, who I characterize as the kind of cynical just war person. I lived in a community house with him for 2 years, and I know Richard. And just amazing people, but for their completely different reasons, they chose to go to prison for a year instead of going to the military. And so conscription has been one of those places where whites are being asked to put their bodies on the line in the support of the apartheid system. And then since the 80s, the army has been coming more and more into the interior of South Africa. And with the state of emergency, the troops now patrol. And it's not even the myth that we are on the borders keeping the communist hordes out from our wonderful country. But they are now policing the townships and enforcing the state of emergency, which is the particular will of a particular political party. I don't know about in America, but in the whole notion in Western democracies is that the army is supposed to be politically neutral. I think that's the case here in the United States and Britain, that it's not tied to the political policies of any one party. But in South Africa, the ruling party has been there for almost 40 years now, 39 years. That it's, you know, the interests of the country and the interests of the government and the interests of the ruling party are all the same as far as they're concerned. And so the army is used to enforce apartheid. And so about 1983, 1984, and probably in 1984, I think it's more likely that a group of people started organizing to not just to support conscientious objectors, because even 100 conscientious objectors a year isn't going to stop the war, but to actually end the system of conscription, end the draft. And it's called the End Conscription Campaign, the ECC. And they've been, alongside the UDF, probably the second most powerful and organized white grouping that's opposing apartheid and opposing the system. That it's tremendously grassroots organized. It's a front of organizations, so again, your church groups and your youth groups and your political groups all belong to it. And that's had a tremendously big impact in the South African society, raising the awareness. It works in high schools with kids when it can, and with youth groups and whatever. And you'll find that if you read in the newspapers of white people who've been detained or imprisoned, they will be either UDF people or ECC people, End Conscription Campaign people. So those are the two real organizations. The one working politically against apartheid, the other working against the military. And I've often thought there's an interesting parallel here with the civil rights movement and the anti-Vietnam thing. And people, the same people would generally be supportive of both of them, but would choose one as their primary activity. But it's interesting that the two have happened in that way. The third area of involvement, and probably the third area of if you saw white people who were arrested or detained, is Christian groups or church groups that white people choose to be involved in. I mean, here I'm talking very much about myself. That the church presents itself, especially through the witness of some of the people who've gone on before, as a real viable place for white people to be involved in, amongst other things, because of course the church is much bigger than this, but making a witness against apartheid and for the gospel. For example, my call to go into the ministry was so strongly tied with the whole apartheid situation. It happened in that kind of context that when people asked me, am I immigrating to the United States? Why didn't I come here? It's much easier. I cannot conceive of myself being a pastor and not being in South Africa. It's almost as if life would be meaningless without the two of them fitting together in that way. Here I can think of a couple of friends of mine who've been involved in Christian organizations or as Christians in political organizations. And that certainly becomes an important area. Especially working with white people who have got a moral basis, at least should have a moral basis to their lives. The church is an important area. A fourth area of involvement is one's career, one's job that one does. This might not seem like a very glamorous choice, and in many cases it isn't. But people have chosen to work in four or five areas for political reasons. Teachers. Many people have chosen, white people have chosen to be teachers. We have this crazy system whereby although no black or colored person can teach in a white school, whites can teach in black and colored schools. It's part of the whole sort of missionary paternalistic thing about South Africa, that whites can help blacks, but heaven help blacks who try and help whites. And people have chosen that as an area of trying to educate, trying to empower black or colored kids with education and with the skills that they've had. Or maybe it's even in a more informal education, setting up alternative education projects, or working with youth in an area. The press is probably the most glamorous place to get involved. There are a number of good journalists who work, who have this kind of political persuasion, and therefore friends, and therefore able to get in to various situations and able to write and to communicate that kind of thing. And the press, one of the reasons why censorship is so strong is not simply to stop people from knowing, but to crush the voice of a community. Those newspapers that I've had here and shown around, I wonder if anybody's managed to see them. The one, especially the Weekly Mail, is basically the newspaper that represents this political position. And you'll get a feel for that too if you read the cultural and the sports pages, because they pick up on the sports. For example, soccer is picked up on because soccer is a black sport in South Africa, whereas rugby is a white sport. And cricket is a very white sport in South Africa. South Africa, basically soccer is the most popular sport, but cricket and rugby get the most sponsorship, the most television coverage, and the most newspaper coverage because they're white sports. It's part of the whole thing. And culturally, the press is able to write about plays and dramas and writings like this. Health is another one. I'm not going to speak too much on that because that's Marion's forte. But she's going to be talking tomorrow about her job in a squatter clinic as a physical therapist. So you can go into health with her on that one. And law is another option, because the legal system has provided some kind of fight against apartheid. So as you can see, people choose this. Or even engineering, which seems to be the most way out thing for people to do if they want to be involved in a political struggle. Well, in a rural country where water and electricity are at a demand, engineers are really important people politically, if they have that right kind of commitment. And it's something I've noticed far more here than I mean, in South Africa than here, is that people choose their careers from this community, not just for which can make me the most money or whatever, but actually how I can help the situation, and it's a political choice. A fifth area of involvement is cultural. So somebody like Nadine Gordimer, who herself has shifted politically from the liberal position more and more into a progressive or left position, is a writer. Athel Fugard, the playwright, some of you may have heard of. But there's a whole host of younger playwrights and younger writers and musicians and dramatists, and people are using culture as an area in which to work. And the reason I've got the guitar here is I'm going to do one or two songs, if time permits, after I'm finished speaking. Because this is an area where I've done a little bit of work, working with a white group. I play in a group of white people, basically write and perform to the white community as a way of raising awareness and of writing music and of participating in that. And then the fifth area of involvement is in exile. A tremendous number of white South African professionals are leaving the country for their political views. Not because they themselves are being harassed or put in prison, but because they feel that the situation is getting to the point where they can't bring up children or they can't be involved in their job or whatever. And that gets pretty close to home for some of us, that we will have brothers and sisters or whatever leaving the country. And people can leave the country simply as protest with a hope to come back. Some people can emigrate. I have an uncle and aunt on my father's side and an uncle and aunt on my mother's side living here in America. They're not politically, what we'd say, politically sussed. I mean, is that an American word to say somebody's sussed about it? They're not politically switched on or whatever. But they've left for political they've left for political reasons, if you really push them. So I have cousins living in Atlanta, Georgia, and cousins in Erie, Pennsylvania. And Marion, for example, has her sister and brother-in-law living in England. And that's becoming such a reality for this white community. Now, more and more white South Africans leaving. For many, the hope is to come back at some stage. For many, it's to emigrate. And then for some in exile, there's the explicit involvement in organizations in exile. If you remember, we talked about the fact that politically in South Africa, you have opposition groups internally and externally in exile. So in New York, for example, a couple of white South Africans that I met had contacts with groups in exile and chose to be politically involved in that. Okay, finally, I just wanted to say, I put the two words in context, because I wanted to finish this off, and it might be very obvious for some of you, but I need to remind myself at least that everything I've talked about today must be seen in context. That I've talked about the white community, which is a small percentage of the South African community, and then I've talked about the tiniest percentage of the white community in South Africa. So two things. The first is that this is not, these people are not the salvation of South Africa. The group is far too small. It's far too eclectic. It's far too impotent in terms of the resources it has. But it's a tremendously creative group of people. But secondly, that in context, we must talk about the fact that for people here, the struggle is a struggle that must be led by black people, and that the black agenda must be clear, because it's so often white people have tried to lead the black struggle and actually ended up simply putting their own fears and their own agenda onto the map. Which is not wrong, but they mustn't then pretend that it's the black agenda. Do you know what I'm getting? I mean, I think the white fears and the white agenda have a role, but when you say that these are actually the black fears and the black agenda, when they really are yours. So the in context is that
it cannot be salvation because it's too small, but also because it's perhaps too white. But it's a very creative group and really involved in that. And I think what's going to happen more and more of those who committed to stay is that it's going to become what I've thought about as a culture of resistance. That the way we choose to live, the way we choose to get married, the way we choose to bring up our children, the way we choose to educate them, is going to become a culture of resistance. In other words, the context of our lives is one where I'm starting to see more and more that I don't know if my children are going to be born into a free South Africa, let alone their children. And that means we have to talk about a length of time. The struggle can't come, you know, we can't work 9 to 5 and then get involved in the political struggle. The job we're doing from 9 to 5, the place we live, the friends we make, is all part of the context in which that struggle for the white community needs to take place. Right, this is the shortest talk we've given so far. I'm quite proud about that. If I may say that perhaps at 10 to, we have 15 minutes of discussion on that, and then at 10 to 5, if you're interested, perhaps I can sing one or two songs, if that would, be nice.
Steve? One of the areas that you did mention is the armed struggle. Are there whites in the 2% uh-huh. who are joining in the effort?
Yeah. Okay.
By the resistance, guerrilla resistance, or whatever one calls it.
Yeah. That's actually, thanks. I'm just actually going to write this on my piece of paper for whenever I give the speech again. Yes, that's been going on for a while. When the ANC was banned in 1961, and it initiated a program of armed struggle in about 63, there was a group of whites who, inside the country, who formed an organization called the African Resistance Movement, ARM, A-R-M. And they were going to be whites inside the country involved in military things. The one thing they tried to do was to blow up a radio receiver mast outside Cape Town, and it was a bit of a flop, and the police caught them. There's a marvelous book being written by one of the people who then spent time in prison about that. And in fact, Marion has an uncle who was involved in something like that, who went into exile after that. So you might want to speak to her about that. That's a bit historical. And then there was a period, and that kind of frightened a lot of whites. And it also made them very aware that white academics who have history degrees are not the people to go out blowing buildings, you know. This is some of the things you start realizing, that actually your engineers and your architects, who you despised as people who just wanted to make money, you start realizing that they actually have the skills to blow up and to reconstruct far more than you as a sociology lecturer do. But I think that frightened a lot of whites off. And it was perhaps Soweto in 1976, so that was 15 years later. Then in 1980, there was another big uprising. And then I think the whole military conscription thing has forced a lot of white, a lot of my age group, school friends and that, would have left the country. Now, for some of them, it's become evident by a couple of recent political trials that whites are being returned into the country with weapons as ANC military cadres. There was one person recently arrested with machine guns and ammunition in their home and stood trial, and I think sentenced to about 15 years in prison. But you see, the ANC has said to the white community that's all excited about being involved in the non-racial struggle, oh yeah, if you're so involved and so interested, how come you're not actually fighting, carrying guns for us? And that's, you know, that's been a kind of dampener on the white enthusiasm for being politically relevant. But yeah, that's an interesting thing, and that might happen more and more.
What are some of the discussions going on about violence and non-violence? Is non-violence seen as very naive at this point?
Interesting. I mean, if you asked people the question, people would say, yes, non-violence is naive. But if you try to make a list of all the activities that have happened in the past 2 years, you'd find that non-violence predominates about 98%. And a person, a guy called Walter Wink, some of you might or might not know him, he's a Christian theologian type person, has written a book on nonviolence in South Africa.
But he makes the point that perhaps nowhere else ever in the world since 1980 has more non-violent techniques ever been tried than in South Africa. Strikes, boycotts, stayaways, teach-ins, alternative schools, you know, the whole gamut. So you have this really funny situation where everybody will admit that non-violence is irrelevant, but everybody's involved in non-violent activities. But the discussion, I think, centers around the fact that, how can I put it, that the army, the military in South Africa, is not a neutral force. That even if you get the government willing to talk to other people, the army itself might in fact decide no. And that even if the official what was the official opposition came to power under an election, the 40 years in which the army and the government have been so intertwined, I mean, that's almost why you can never even perceive that this party would have become the official of the government, because they wouldn't be able to put their things into force because the army and the police would refuse to do it for them. And I think more and more people are starting to see that the real struggle is how to enforce democracy and justice. So even if you've won it, if you don't control the military force, you're not going to do it. And that means, like in Zimbabwe, that maybe you even have to escalate your war to the point that after independence, you can bring two armies together. If you remember in Zimbabwe, the White Army and the Black Liberation Armies, within 2 weeks, I think, were completely integrated. And it stopped the possibility of a coup d'etat, and it also meant that the army was now politically neutral because it combined both forces. And so my fear is that even if the government changes non-violently, the right wing, and that still possesses so many arms and ammunition, that they're going to, it's going to make the Contras look like Sunday school teachers. You know, I mean, so I think that that's also starting to come into the discussion. Does that help you? I mean, apart from the regular philosophical discussions about whether it's right to take a person's life and whether it isn't, and whether you can do it in self-defense or defense of the weak, you know, those kind of things. Sorry,
Do you think the current government is limited in what they can do because of the threat of the army?
Because of the army?
Right. The current government.
Yeah, interestingly enough, you see, up until the reforms, up until Botha became prime minister, you didn't have this split. The governing party was like that. And with Botha's reforms, the right wing split away. Perhaps the extreme right wing split away. Now, that means up until between 1948 and 1982, you had one party, one church, one army, one civil service, one people, one folk. I mean, so you could count on the fact that everybody who went to your church, who was in your police force, who was your officer in the army, who was your MP, was all the same party, and all saw Botha as the thing. Now you have a split, and the interesting thing is that most of the lower officers in the military and in the police are in this political grouping. And they are the people who traditionally have, you know, organized coup d'etats. So, I mean, I don't know what the possibility is, but you have the situation now where the officers in the army are to the right of the present government. Mm-hmm. And if you can believe that, yeah. Yeah, well, but you see, it's Botha's reforms where he's let coloureds and Indians into parliament. Can you believe that? You know, I mean, that's the kind of way it goes on about. The next thing he's going to let blacks in, and then communists. And the next thing he's going to have sold the country to the communists. I mean, that's not, I mean, I'm saying it with a smile on my face, but that's pretty hard-nosed analysis from this side. So yeah, the military becomes, you reach the situation where, to some extent, the military already controls the country. You know, and for example, the state of emergency. When they declared the state of emergency, they didn't recall parliament. So it was never debated, it was never passed by parliament, it was a decree by Botha. And it was enforced by the military. And it's the military who say, we can't keep the lid on this thing, we need another decree. You know, so you're getting yourself into that situation.
And the other thing is that before Botha was Prime Minister, he was the Minister of Defence. And in the Westminster parliamentary system, when it doesn't work exactly here, but a cabinet minister will generally take over the prime minister position. They tend to bring their people who were with them into the office. And so there was no longer a minister of defense. So who did he appoint? He appointed a general to be minister of defense. And in the parliamentary system, it's you're supposed to be an elected member of parliament to hold a cabinet post. So they passed a law that, no, we're allowed to appoint who we want to cabinet posts. So you have a general sitting in the cabinet, Magnus Malan. And those are sort of obvious signs, but actually when you start realizing with the state of emergency who runs the country, it's the military. And it's going to be interesting to see at which point the military decide we need more reactionary policies, and the government says, in order to keep this thing afloat, in order to keep outside investors investing, we need more positive things, and the two fall apart.
Another instance was the shooting down of President Samora Machel in Mozambique, killed by a missile. And the only notices that came out was that the army had actually done it without any instructions from the government. And there was a big fuss and a bother, and conflicting statements came out every hour. It was actually a case that the army actually did their thing, and then the government was informed.
And one of the things, the other interesting things that I'd heard was both Marion and my parents are friendly with a member of parliament, a person called Alex Berain, who is no longer a member of parliament. He walked out of it in disgust, but when he was there, he forced a meeting with the Minister of Police, Louis Lafrangie, and he asked him to condemn police atrocities, as people are wont to. And Louis Lafrangie confided to him and said, I cannot condemn police atrocities. I have to support the police in whatever they do because they are doing things that I do not order. And they are going to start calling me weak and liberal, and they're not going to start listening to me anymore. So it's not me trying to control them. It's me trying to keep being seen as their leader all the time. And he basically admitted that the police are out there to actually, because they no longer support, I mean, they fought the election again, they have the official opposition. So policemen who belong to this party, all they want to do is embarrass this party. So they're going to commit as many atrocities as possible. They don't get the flak. It's the governing party that does. And that's, he confided in that. So it's, I mean, he wouldn't say it publicly, but that was one of the dilemmas going on. So I think Marion's point about the army going on and doing their own thing is,
it's not unfamiliar to us, that occurrence.
Yeah, you get the feeling perhaps with the Contragate thing that some of the army people didn't went and did what they wanted to do and then informed Congress.
Exactly.
Perhaps if there's, oh, you had a question, yeah, and then I'm.
If you speak to the organizations in the black community in terms of violence, non-violence, I mean, about blacks against blacks.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Can I read some about the violence of blacks against other blacks?
Yeah. Where would be a good place to start this from? The black community is divided politically. And most of the black-on-black violence have been blacks involved in what are known as progressive organizations, the UDF or the ZAPO, and blacks involved in reactionary politics. In Inkatha, which is Chief Gacha Buthelezi's little political party and military, all blacks that have bought into the government openings for them in urban areas, what are called community councillors. It's difficult to explain where they come in, but basically it's self, I mean, blacks have been appointed by whites to rule over the blacks and to be the credible black leaders that the white government talks to. And that, I mean, black, it's very similar, and I often say this as an analogy, it's, you know, in the Second World War, a French resistance fighter killed a French person who was working for the Nazi government. Papers didn't go crazy about French-on-French violence.
you know, they understood there's a political analysis going on here, that it's one side against another on a political ground. And the government talks about it as black-on-black violence because it blurs the morals, but it's actually, if you'd had the analysis, it's the French resistance or the black resistance against those French or those blacks who are being used by the Germans or the South African whites to rule over them. I mean, it's pretty much that kind of thing. And I think if you were opposed to the French resistance killing French in that situation, then you can be opposed to blacks doing that. But if in a time of war, in a time of struggle for democracy and freedom and liberty and all those kinds of things, some of those things are necessary, as in France and as in South Africa. I mean, that's how one would legitimate it politically. Morally, perhaps you can't legitimate it. I mean, killing other people. But I think the anger and the frustration and the hatred for black people who are making money, because they get paid handsome salaries, to do that is tremendous. But interestingly enough, although it's felt for the community councillors and whatever, for the average black person who might be a black policeman or a black member of Inkatha, those people are understood as being misled, and so most of the thing is against those who should know better, the leaders. Yeah.
So the others let alone.
To a large extent, yeah, because I think the black organizations are sophisticated enough to know that the last thing they want to do is start precisely a black-on-black genocide in which it becomes a clan affair or it becomes a personal grudge thing.
Certainly the way in which it's done, if you just want to kill people, you would do it a different way. It's done in a very symbolic, ritual manner.
Yeah.
As a message, I guess, to a larger community.
It's very, it's meant to intimidate others not to do it. It's pretty, I've often, now, the manner of death, which is a kind of gruesome crucifixion, burning of people, is not the same as the guillotine because it takes much longer, but it has that kind of symbolic guillotine thing of the French Revolution, you know, that this is the way we do it, and it's such a horrific thing, such a public spectacle, that we're going to try and make people so scared that they won't get involved.
Be generous at 5:30 so you have as much time as you
want. Okay.
5:15.
Okay, well, let me perhaps do one or two songs, and they might lead to conversation and now, when the full staff got together about 3 or 4 days ago, and we all had to say one dream that we have, I said, my dream is to find somebody with a decent voice who can sing with me. Now, Marion has a decent voice, but we haven't had enough time to work on some stuff together, so... I specifically play in a group with other musicians so that they can sing. This is a song that was... written about 1985, just outside Cape Town. The area where I live in Cape Town is a coloured township. And you may have seen some of the stuff on your TVs. It was the last stuff that came through before the state of emergency cut it down, of street battles, barricades, burning tires, and army vehicles coming down, and police vehicles, and the kids throwing stones, and that kind of thing. And of course, in the process, people were killed. And this is a song about that, and an attempt to perhaps raise the issue within a white audience in South Africa. Sorry, I'm going to need a second.
You can live in a black township?
No,
No. What did you just say?
I am pretty close to where I live. Uh-huh. Yeah. In Cape Town, the suburbs are close.
Child strode down Thornton Road, a body racked by a heavy load, apartheid law, civil war. She seen the pain and hurt her parents bore. she will take no more. Children meet, she feels the heat of burning tires against the street. She hears the hate, she just can't wait to take her anger out upon the state. One small step in shaping her own fate. The trap is laid, the children build a barricade, make a stand with stone in hand, to rid injustice from this land and save another age from being damned. To a sound of guns, the body lies, the mother cries, and she wipes her tears from her eyes, grieving as another child dies. Headline screams, shattered dreams, the blood runs thick into the streams. Night is long, a child is gone, yet to her strength we sing this song, knowing that her struggle will go on.
This is one of, if you remember, I told you about those two friends of mine, Peter Moll and Richard Steele, who became conscientious objectors. Actually, retuning this will take a bit. Now, a third friend was a person called Charles Yates, and he had a particularly interesting pilgrimage to becoming a conscientious objector. And this song is an attempt to capture that with poetic license. He basically grew up in a community where he didn't know what the heck was going on with his life. He's one of those people who was called up, what we call called up, conscripted and called up to fight, and that became the crisis point. And his struggle and talking and discussions led him to see that, and he chose to become a conscientious objector. Now, I talk about in the song, at one point I mention a thing called the call-up papers. And I don't know what the equivalent in America would be. It's not the draft card. It's the papers that sort of arrive in the mail to say you must be at point X at, you know, to start your military training. Sliding off my leg. Have you ever seen a guitar like this before?
No, never.
It's amazing, isn't it? It's Martin Muller's.
Yesterday I lay upon my bed and wondered what's going on. So many things inside my head, and I don't know right from wrong. And the television tells me one thing, and the papers tell me two. I'm so mixed up and I don't know what to do. Then I met an old man who told me what you're hearing are just the views of the people who got the money, can buy the press, and so can slot the news. I went home, thought about this, well, I thought both night and day. other people's point of view. And there I discovered a world so different, yet so true. A world forgotten by the people who write the elsewhere.